The Tale of the Frozen Pussy, Slipper Trip, The Million Dollar Fee. These are just a few of the strange cases and wild tales you will hear on Miami Memoirs. Join Florida attorney Louis Ress as he recounts his 6 decades of legal practice in the wilds of South Florida.
Welcome to another episode of Miami Memoirs. This is Megan stepping in for Peter here with Louis.
That's me. I'm here.
Louis is always here. And so what story are we talking about today, Louis?
Well, we're getting into some exciting, uncharted territory here. And you better have a very thick skin and not be sexually sensitive, because this is a subject about satirism. And the name of the story is called What is a Satyr?
What is a satyr?
I'm glad you asked. It's a Greek word. And, of course, a lot of sexuality comes from the history, Greek history. And it's a neurotic condition. And it's a compulsion to have sex with as many women as possible. So it's a male disorder and a psychiatric disorder. And also, there's an inability on the person that suffers from this disease to have lasting relationships with women. So it's two things: an uncontrollable desire for sex with as many women as you can, and an inability to have a lasting relationship with a woman. So I'll tell you more about it.
Okay.
Most people don't know what a satyr is, and it's spelled S-A-T-Y-R. Maybe you've seen pictures of the man, half animal, but with ram's horns and a tail and a huge penis. And, you know, it's a Greek symbol, and it's been there since 500 BC and more. So now you see it, and you don't even realize it. You see it today in advertising on television, where this guy's sitting on the motorcycle, but there's no body. He's built into the motorcycle, and he's filling himself up with gasoline.
Oh, yeah, I have seen that ad, actually.
Where do you think that came from? That just didn't happen. That's a form of satyrism, where he's half man, half motorcycle. Well, this was half man, half animal, with ram's horns and a big penis. Well,
can't forget about that.
It's very male. And it's lecherous, sure. In other words, it's a guy who can't get enough sex. It's just a Greek myth, or is it real? Well, let me tell you, it's not just a Greek myth. It's real. Some say, and you've seen it, some say that it's an illness, and it might make a hell of a good psychiatric defense in a criminal case. And everybody's missed that. The lawyers who are so smart have missed that. In other words, it's a sexual disease, a psychiatric disease. And the people that do this are psychiatrically impaired, and it's a compulsive thing, and they can't control it. But I'll tell you more about it. The disease is called satyriasis. So I guess my friends Don and Larry were sick long before that illness affected the behavior of a bunch of our male corporate executives, United States senators, congressmen, and many past and even present presidents. And I'll tell you more about them. You think that Donald Trump is the only one that's had Stormy Daniels? Well, there's been a long history of that sort of behavior.
I don't doubt it.
With presidents. And anyhow, my friend Don was a doctor. He was a well-known, highly respected medical specialist. And he propositioned women. Women that he met on airplanes, nurses, patients, young, old, short, fat, white, black, everything in between. In the days that I'm talking about, they had just invented the pill. So I guess it was in the 70s. You know, the pill, where right. The women can take the pill and don't have to worry about getting pregnant. So there was very little sexual disease going around in those days. And they had very low rates of sexually transmitted diseases like gonorrhea, syphilis, and such. So there was a wild scramble by women. The women wanted to feel free. It was the freedom, sexual freedom for women. And they would become the aggressors. And they would call guys on the phone and ask for dates. And women were calling the men. Women were burning their bras. There was no exam or x-ray machines at airports. So women went on the airplane. Some of them weren't wearing underpants. It was a wild period of time. And I lived through it. Well, there was a chiropractor on the ground floor of our office building. Who was sexually adjusting many of his patients, including his best friend's wife. Marijuana was all over the place. It was like a huge carnal celebration. It was like a huge orgy. It was like the end of Prohibition, where everyone ran out and got drunk. Also, the doctor, Don, who was a medical specialist, had access to hard drugs, and he supplied wealthy celebrity patients with pain medications. And if I told you, you would easily recognize their names. One of them was a famous vocalist, and she tried to sing at Don's funeral, but she was too hoarse. She was rasping and croaking, and she died shortly thereafter of an overdose, not long after the funeral. And when I tell you about her daughter, you'll know exactly who it is, because her daughter died of a drug overdose shortly thereafter, too. So I don't want to mention her name in public, because it's not fair to her. She's not here to defend herself.
Right.
But she had a lot of problems. And she lived in the building that I live in also, a fancy condo here in Aventura. And anyhow, that's the setting and the beginning, the prelude for the real story about the famous satyr, Larry, my friend Larry.
Okay.
And I'll tell you about Larry. Larry was a thin, wiry young guy. He's about my age. He's dead now, but he was 30 at the time. He had blondish hair, light skin, and a small but slightly bulbous nose. His blue eyes were dancing most of the time. He spoke softly, and he had a lilt in his voice, and his clothing fit like a glove. He usually wore English shirts with French cuffs and pleated slacks. His alligator loafers had real gold Gucci emblems, and of course no socks, if you please. And certainly he had a diamond Rolex and a star sapphire pinky ring. He had a customized gold money clip. Women thought that he looked like Elvis, and he had a cute smile too. He hadn't always been like that. He came out of the trailer parks. He started out leaving high school early and working in construction with a hammer and a saw. And he learned how to operate machinery, first trucks of all kinds, and then he learned how to operate bulldozers and ultimately drag lines. You know, those are the big excavating machines with the heavy tank treads and like a military tank. And they have a long trestle or arm that has cables running through it from the cab where you sit up to the arm where is a roller, and then the metal lines or cables go down to a metal bucket, a large metal bucket, and they dig or dredge up ground, you know, earth, sand. And they were designed to pick up piles of material, mostly sand, in the bucket and deposit it, either into a dump truck or into a pile of material. Larry scraped up enough money to buy a used dump truck, and he started out hauling fill when he was 18. He had two trucks, and then three, and then a second-hand DC-3 bulldozer, which is like a Caterpillar small bulldozer. And finally, he had a small used drag line. And he was 21 when he bid on his first government job. It was a disaster. Besides mechanical breakdowns, he had underestimated the extent and difficulty of the dirt removal, and it became clear that he was going to go into default. He was facing bankruptcy. He had personally guaranteed the job instead of getting a performance bond. And even if you get a performance bond from a bonding company, they require you to hold them harmless anyhow, to indemnify them. So he was in trouble. He visited the government contracting office where he had bid for the contract, and he begged for some relief. Well, the project superintendent was a very solidly built, handsome, middle-aged woman who was sexually attracted to him. She devoured him with her eyes. He was cute. He was very, very sexy. And Larry could have taught in the Method School of Acting. He was contrite. He was sweet. And he was schoolboy charming. As she went around the desk, she brushed against him. She put her hand on his shoulder. And then when she felt no resistance, she put her hand on his lower back. Then on his buttocks. On his behind. She had a small black leather couch in her office and her own bathroom. It was a very hot affair in every way. They went at it. They had intercourse twice a day, in her office, on the couch, on the floor, on the desk, and in his pickup truck, in the cab of the drag line, and every other place you can imagine, except her bed, since they never knew when her husband would be coming home. So the supervisor, so she was, they call it horny, but it's not, and that's the word. Horny comes from the horns that they ground down from the ram.
Right.
And that's part of it was an aphrodisiac. I'm being very open with you because there's nothing, you know, to hide about the story. It's a true story.
Oh, yeah, no, absolutely.
So there are women that have an abnormal sex drive. They are called nymphomaniacs. The word nymph goes back to the Greek, and maniac means out of control. So they behaved like nymphs. So the nymphs were historically sexually active women. They had wings, some of them were like goddesses, and they're all through Greek mythology. This has been going on from time immemorial, all the way back. Well,
I didn't realize there was a specific one, like a specific term for the male version.
Yeah, the female version is nymphomania. So this woman was as sexually excited having sex as much as she could as my friend was, Larry. He was actually wanted sex as much as he could. Well, when they got together, it was like two thunderstorms colliding. It was an explosion. It was very nice. She fell in love with him, actually. And she conducted Larry through a little-known process to assist and protect first-time government contractors. And with her guidance, his contract was amended and adjusted to award additional funds and to lengthen the time for performance. And this was a kid that was going bankrupt. She also arranged for a large cash advance to be authorized. And he didn't know about that. She was knew the inside track and government contracting. She saved Larry. Well, he started to bid on Florida State Highway construction through the Department of Transportation, paving roads and building roads. And that's when he met and partnered with Ricky Elmont. The company was known as Elmont and Baskett, or E&B, INC. Ricky had been around for a while and knew how to arrange to be the low bidder. He explained to Larry how Manny Levin got to be in control of all the roads that were paved and built in Palm Beach County. Levin Construction was king in Palm Beach. Secret payments, subcontracts, or other compensation was given to the other bidders, so they would bid very high. You slipped in under them, just under them. Then there was the appeal process to amend the contract after you got it awarded and while it was going along. That's where the big profits came. Well, for example, they would find that the subsoil was different than in the specifications under the bid. The amount of muck or mud was significantly greater than is represented in the contract. And you had the photos and the tests and the surveys from friendly sources to prove it. Well, Manny Levin lived in a palace on the ocean in Palm Beach and mingled with the socialites up there, so why not us? After my law partner, George Case, became president of Grand Bahama Island Enterprises, he introduced me to Larry. That's how I met Larry. And Larry was dredging the harbor in Freeport in the Bahamas. And Larry retained me, and I had been representing him for a few months as his attorney. Initially, he didn't talk a lot about women or sex, but he had a 16-year-old girlfriend living in his apartment in the Bahamas. And he would disappear for hours at a stretch. No one could find him or reach him. No one knew where he was. There were no cell phones or pagers then. One day we were sitting in his very large office in Fort Lauderdale, and Larry's feet were up on his antique desk, which had gold eagles on the top corners of the desk. When he grinned, he said, "Man, it's been 2 hours and I haven't been laid." He used his forefinger and thumb to pull on his French cuffs. He pulled the sleeves out of his jacket, and I noticed two beautifully worked gold cufflinks with small diamonds in them. He took out a little phone directory and thumbed through it, and he had manicured fingers. I saw him, and he pulled out a phone, went up to his phone, and it was a golden phone he had on his desk, and he dialed up this number, and the conversation was quite unexpectedly short. He said, "Hi, darling, you guessed it, I'd love to. Yes, right now. I'll be there soon. Miss you, dear. Bye-bye." Larry looked at me with a boyish grin. "She's got the sweetest pussy." And he went on and on with a detailed description of the lady's pubic hair, its color, its softness, like silk. Then he gave me a full description of her body from head to toe. Before he excused himself, he'd arranged for a late afternoon meeting with a married woman and a dinner date with a secretary from a doctor's office. He insisted on telling me about each woman's sexual preferences, their favorite positions, the course and color of their pubic hair, and whether it was curly. He discussed the bikini haircut and how some women dyed their pubic hair to achieve a match with their other tresses. He was quite a guy. He was still doing it two times a day. Ricky Elmont was, before Larry bought him out, an expert on business entertainment. And the parties always had the same elements. And the guests were the same guests, and they never tired of the same thing. There had to be booze, plenty of booze, plenty of liquor. There had to be broads, plenty of broads. That means women. And besides that, Larry had a personal stable of girlfriends in his book. And then he had lists of professionals, prostitutes. Then he had lists of semi-professionals. Then he had lists of party girls. And then he had nice girls who were looking to get married. So he had this whole list of different people and different women. And it really gives you an insight of what goes on in women's lives in that age group between, let's say, 19 and 30, where they have different levels of sexual activity and interest and goals. Some of them are becoming professional streetwalkers, and others are looking to get married, and totally different goals in life and directions in life. Anyhow, at his parties, there's always food and some type of entertainment, usually a live band. No records, they don't like records, no photographs, no pictures. And the guys should be people with whom Larry was doing business or wanted to do business. And the best places for his parties were hotels. So here he has these parties for entertainment. I had to go because I was his attorney, so when he invites you, you gotta go. I was like his Giuliani. He said, come, I went. So the first party I was invited to was at the Miami Springs Villas. Larry had a relationship with a lady named Carol. She was a very nice redhead. She was an older woman, probably around 40, who arranged for 8 professionals to entertain the guests. The party started off in a small private room with a guitar player. There was a buffet table, but nothing special. And then it happened. The older woman called for everyone's attention. She then introduced her girlfriends, one at a time, telling a little bit about each one, including the fact that she went to college. Each was young, trim, attractive, and would be assigned to one of the 8 guests. And she said, please tell gentlemen your name and where you went to college, as she addressed each girl. And these girls were standing there. She called them up one at a time. And most of the 8 fellows that were there hadn't finished high school. And I don't think they ever read a book or even a newspaper, maybe other than the sports section. So they were impressed by these college girls. And one of them said, oh, I'm Anita, and I went to Florida State. And then the next one got up and said, I'm Sandra, and I'm a Noel also. And the next one got up and said, I'm Carla, and I went to Vassar College. And the next one said, my name is Shirley, and I went to Smith, but only for 2 years. Most of the rest said that they were Florida State graduates. Frankly, I didn't believe any of it. Anyhow, after a few drinks, they all went off with their dates to separate rooms in the villa. And I was left with a young lady who clearly was very unhappy to be with me, as uncomfortable as I was with her. And it was instant mutual dislike. She looked me up and down. I'm about 5'6" tall. The other guys were all 6-footers. And she said, you're strictly JV. Well, that means worse than second string. That's junior varsity. I was stunned by the insult from a prostitute. I started to feel warm all over. My first reaction was to be anger. My face turned red. I was really offended. I was hurt, but I kept my big mouth shut. Then a feeling of relief came over me, and I smiled, and I said, you know, you're right. I am strictly JV. Let's just have a drink. Well, she was relieved. She immediately picked up on it, and we talked a little bit, and then the next thing that happened was that the group came back into the room. And there was what can only be called an orgy. There were at least 4 couples. There were at least 4 couples exchanging partners and fornicating on the various couches on the floor. And on the floor.
This sounds like a movie, isn't it?
Well, it's like a pornographic movie. Then Larry was making it with the older woman. And she was a redhead. And I slipped out since I knew half of the men, and I didn't want to be known by any of the women. I got out of there. What I found out later was very interesting. Carol, the older woman, was the personnel director of an exclusive employment agency, and they advertised in the Coral Gables and South Miami area for housewives who wanted to make substantial compensation as social hostesses, working afternoons only. The agency was highly discreet, and in fact, Carol was the owner, and I never saw any of them again. So that was the orgy down, that was at Miami Springs Villas, by the way, down on 36th Street near the airport. Well, there was no getting out of Larry's Christmas party. It was another one of his bashes. It was at Pier 66. This time, I had a good idea of what was coming. But Larry was paying me the equivalent of $1,000 an hour way back then, and I wasn't about to turn him down when he invited me. But I did tell my wife. And I told him what could happen also. So surprisingly enough, it was quite straight. There was a five-piece band, and they had a ballroom in the Pier 66. And Larry's secretary, Dolores, escorted me into the ballroom with about 60 people in there, including some very conservatively dressed young women. He introduced me to some of Larry's business associates, including Jake Raven. Jake Raven was very friendly. He was wearing a dark gray business suit, clearly custom fitted, and he included me in the conversations he was having with three lovely women. Jake had just finished doing a one-year jail term for bid rigging. That is, rigging the bids for government construction, for road contracting. And he had taken the rap for his boss, Manny Levin, who was the king of Palm Beach.
Right.
And I noticed that there were no waiters, and the drinks were help yourself with no bartenders. Also, there were some very big men, very big, standing at the door. About 30 minutes into the party, the doors were closed. No one else seemed to notice. They were busy drinking and talking. The band was playing. Two extremely beautiful girls started to embrace at the side of the room. At first, they seemed to be dancing. They kissed one another on the lips. Their hands roamed over one another, including fondling one another's breasts and rubbing on one another's behind. They undressed, and somehow it was contagious. The other women at the party started taking off their clothes. It didn't take that long for all of the 30 women to disrobe. The 30 men were naked, too. The two original ladies started to kiss one another in the crotch. A hand grabbed me by the shoulder. It engaged my arm. It directed me towards the door, and the lady said, "We're out of here." It was Larry's secretary, Dolores. She hustled me out into the foyer and said that my wife had already been told to expect me home within an hour.
She saved me.
So what's going on here? How did it happen? Who are these people? Well, Dolores told me. Some of the men were mid-level executives of the Department of Transportation. That's the Florida Department of Transportation.
Oh,
and the women were a mix, a mingle, of six prostitutes, six party girls, and the rest were office workers. When the signal were given, the prostitutes started to perform and undress, and the others just went along with the flow. The moral of the story.
Yeah.
Every one of my stories is true. In all respects, in every detail, they're true. And underneath that all, it's like Aesop's fables. You're going back to Greek mythology. Aesop wrote these fables, like the fox and the grapes, where the
right.
fox tried to get the grapes, they were too high, and then he said, sour grapes, they were no good anyhow. So there was a story underneath this story. And what it tells you is about the sexual frustration and the use of sex as a business tool. It is a business tool, and you want to get business, you take a guy out and you fix him up with a woman, and the woman very often is paid to do it, and the man then is in your control. He's captured because you may have pictures of it, you know the girl,
okay.
And now, let's say he's the manager of a company and you're the attorney and he's your client and you fix him up. That client knows that if he discharges you, a copy of that photograph of him in bed with that woman is going to wind up in his wife's possession. So he's not going to mess with you.
Right.
Now, what's going on today where that could be happening? And I told you there's a lot of undercurrent, and this is not in my notes, but it just occurs to me. Your president... Donald Trump is
don't put it on me. That's your president,
your
too.
He's your president.
He's your president, too.
He's very pro-Russian, and there's a big underlying concern that the Russians, and particularly Secretary General Putin, has photographs or tapes of him engaged in sexual misbehavior in Russia some time ago that are very revealing and embarrassing. And would damage him very, very severely. So he is under the control of the person that possesses those tapes. And if that's the case, that would explain a lot. And this is what I'm telling you about. So when you're doing business with people in the Department of Transportation of Florida, you're doing business with the State Department.
Uh-huh.
And in the United States, and it's no different. So it's a sexual, a behavior is a tool. And you can control people with it. And it's used... in business a lot. It's corruption. and it's a change in values. Then there is the sexuality drive of people. I'm going to name some presidents, and I'm going to ask you to tell me who was the most sexually aggressive of these presidents, okay?
Okay.
Donald Trump, Bill Clinton, John F. Kennedy, or Johnson?
Well, we know that Kennedy and Clinton both had extra, like, it's documented that they had extramarital affairs.
When you got President Trump paying off Stormy Daniels.
Yeah.
He's not paying her off because he likes her. And then you had Lyndon Johnson.
I don't know much about Lyndon Johnson.
Okay, we'll find out because he was the one.
Oh.
He could dance with a woman, married woman on the dance floor and put his hands all over her on the dance floor. And he was an extremely aggressive sexual predator.
Because he was the one who was just super aggressive in general, right? That he would get, that he would get, like, senators and the people alone and, like, do, like,
sure.
The close talking and stuff.
Oh, sure.
Okay, that tracks that he would do that in all areas, I guess.
He would do that in everything. He was a pressure-type individual. He'd call you up and blackmail you, threaten you. They all do that. You don't think Kennedy did it? He did.
Oh, no, I totally.
And Robert Kennedy was the same way. And if you cross them, they would destroy you. This is no different. You think Mr. Trump is different from them?
No.
And Bill Clinton any different? They're not.
No.
They're not. So I think I've given you quite an insight.
Yeah.
Jeffrey Epstein was a satyr, and he wanted to have his head and his penis frozen. I forget what you call it, for eternity.
Cryogenic.
Yes, yeah. Cryogenics. He wanted to have that done. Did you know that?
Nope.
Well, you learned something.